If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Live from Liverpool, The Dark Paranormal, Season 20.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another installment of this week's Dark Paranormal, Season 20, Episode 6. And do not ask me how we are already in the second half of this season. I have no idea, the time has absolutely flown, but I will say this, I believe personally, the stories that we've had, be it on minisodes, be it on the main episode, definitely on Dark Bites, have been some of the most amazing stories I genuinely believe we've ever covered. And I sincerely mean that wholeheartedly. This is not a the best season yet sort of promotional shout. The stories we've covered have genuinely left me questioning those stories for days on end, especially some of the ones we've covered on Dark Bites. And as I say, right now, throughout the month of June, you can go and listen to those shows by grabbing your free week trial over at patreon.com/thedarkparanormal. Believe me, it will end at the end of June. I don't know if we'll ever do it again unless there's a special occasion or reason to do so, but I would if I was you. As a paranormal fan, head over, claim your free week, and see if you enjoy it. And if you don't, you leave no harm, no foul. But we've introduced a new way of doing Dark Bites. Our little team put together the episode for me. So I don't necessarily pick the episodes. My expressions or opinions are genuine because I'll be reading them out for the first time, hearing them for the first time, along with you. And that's a wonderful way for me to record, because it takes away any sort of, I've read this story before, I'm rereading it again, which can sometimes feel a little bit monotonous. But doing it in this way means every ounce of excitement I feel, or every ounce of questioning or confusion, should come across, because it's a genuine emotion as I hear things like you for the first time. And it's made me feel like a paranormal fan once more. But before we get to thanking those people who've signed up and paid for Patreon to keep this show going, I need to say something about the upcoming experience. Now, when I say I genuinely think the experiences we've covered so far have been some of the best we've ever covered, this one is one that stuck out to me when it arrived. And it arrived a good few months back. Now, when I said earlier about Dark Bites, sometimes I would, previously, reread the story before it goes into the show. I do that with The Dark Paranormal. Obviously, it's the main show. I have to do that. It would be awful to read a full episode out and realise it was a terrible story. And this feels almost like an arrogant thing to say, considering I haven't even recorded the experience yet, but I know how good this experience is. From a terrifying perspective, of course. In fact, the experiences we've been receiving for Season 20 have been that good for the first time since doing this podcast. I have genuine concerns whether I will do justice to the experience. And I've never felt that experience before. But I'm glad that I do, because it lets me know that the experience that's laid out before me is something special. But before we get there, of course, I am going to thank those wonderful people who keep this show on the road. And those are our wonderful Patreons, that wonderful community that I keep banging on about because they're so special. And our newest members to that wonderful community who will gain everything on the main feed before anyone else, ad-free, and can gain full access not only to the weekly Patreon-only show Dark Bites, which is out every single week of the year, even on the downtime between seasons, but also the entire back catalogue of Dark Bites episodes coming in at well over 100 hours of never-heard-before Patreon-only material. And within that 100 hours, there are at least 250 experiences that you will not have heard. So as I say, this rare free trial opportunity is something I, if I wasn't the host, would be taking advantage of immediately. But right now, a huge thank you to the following newest members to our community, who are Teddy Rosebrand, Catherine Robinson, Farheen Hussein, Marlena Gonzalez-Lage, Paddy Barco, Mary Johnson, Just Me, Gail Darlington-Shaw, Oregon Annie, Ryan Swiss, Pete349, Jules, Rich Heaven, Sally, Writer One, Poltergeist44, Stephen Allen, Wendy Albright, and Jessica X. Well, thank you so much, guys. You are literally keeping the show on the road for everyone else. I genuinely, from the heart, appreciate everything you do. Now, guys, as I say, come the end of June, this free trial will stop, and it possibly may not ever open again until maybe 10 more seasons down the line, if it does at all. So now is the chance to head over to patreon.com/thedarkparanormal and gain your free trial to the highest tier. In all honesty, just to hear the Dark Bite episodes we've had throughout season 20, it is worth it, believe me. But right now, lower your lights. Make yourself comfortable and, of course, leave your disbelief at the door as we hear all about Tap, Tap, Tap. It's Death. Hello. I'm not sure really why I'm writing this now after all of these years, but I suppose there comes a time when you need to get something off your chest, especially if it's something that's been weighing on your chest for the better part of 2 decades. My name is Robin, that's my real name, and I'm what you might call semi-retired these days, as although I can choose my hours, I still do a slight bit of home help around Sheffield in the UK. Nothing too strenuous, just helping elderly folks with their shopping, bits of cleaning, the odd bit of company when their families can't make it. It's work I enjoy, and after spending my lifetime in residential care, I find I actually miss the daily interaction with elder people. They've got stories to tell, wisdom to share, and frankly, they're often much better company than people half their age. But I'm getting ahead of myself. You see, I didn't start out planning to work in care. Like most lads from Sheffield in the 80s, I was thinking more along the lines of the steelworks, or maybe something in engineering. That all changed when my grandfather developed dementia. Now, if you've never dealt with dementia in your own family, it's hard to explain what it does to everyone involved. It's not just the person who forgets things, although that's heartbreaking enough. It's that they kind of become someone else entirely. Bit by bit, day by day. My grandfather, who to me had been like a dad, and a gentle, funny man who taught me to fish and always had a spare mint in his pocket just for me, started becoming confused, then frightened, and then sometimes aggressive, which he just simply never was. I was young, and I'll be honest, I had this horrible feeling about the first time going to this dementia home to visit my granddad. I'd not even seen the place, but I'd built a picture in my mind of some grim institution where old people just walked around, kind of warehoused, I suppose, waiting to die. But the home we found for granddad was nothing like that. I'll call it M. Its full name doesn't begin with an M, but I do want to keep the locations mentioned, especially the residential care places, anonymous to the best of my ability, out of respect. This place was just outside of Sheffield city centre. It was a converted Victorian house with gardens the residents could walk in when the weather was good enough. What struck me most wasn't the building itself. though that was pleasant enough. It was the staff, how they spoke to my granddad and all the other residents. It was a genuine respect, kindness. They knew his name, obviously, but more than that, they remembered things about him. I walked in one day to find one of the care assistants, a beautiful woman named Janet, talking to my granddad about the fact he was a bus driver. And she was talking to him, saying she used to get on his bus, about the routes he used to drive. Now, whether this was true, or she just found out he was a bus driver and was going along with the flow, didn't really matter. My granddad was enthused, engaged, and smiling. Another staff member, Mark, who had this so magical almost aura of gentleness around him, spoke to me to say, "I've worked out your granddad is calmer in the afternoon, so if you're around then, it's a good time to walk in the garden with him." Small little details like that, which are just an additional human touch, which I think is lost a lot today. These aren't medical procedures. They're not anything you'd read in a textbook or learn from a school. These were people just paying attention to another human being, figuring out what made them comfortable, what made them happy, and doing what they could to achieve both. And watching how much difference that made to my granddad's quality of life, well, it massively opened my eyes to something I'd never even considered before. Granddad lived at M for 3 years before he passed. By the end, he didn't really know who any of us were, though he was still treated with dignity every single day by those staff. The staff didn't just keep him fed or clean, though they did that too. They kept him human, if that makes any sense. After the funeral, I found myself thinking more and more about the work those people did. I'd left school at 16 with decent enough grades, but no real direction. I was drifting between temporary jobs. Nothing felt like it mattered. But seeing what proper care could do for someone like my granddad, seeing what it meant to my family, to know how he was somewhere safe and being treated kindly, well, that felt like something worth doing. So I looked into it. This was the mid-80s, remember, and the care sector was starting to professionalise a bit more. You couldn't just walk into a care home and ask for a job. Well, you could try, but the better places wanted people with proper training. And so I enrolled in a health and social care qualification at the local college. It was 2 years of study covering everything from basic nursing skills to understanding different types of dementia, learning about nutrition for elderly people, even modules on activity planning, social engagement. On finishing the course, I applied to several homes around Sheffield. Most wanted people with experience, which is a bit of a catch-22 when you're just starting out. Ironically, it was M, Grandad's old place, that offered me a position as a care assistant. Janet still worked there, and I genuinely think, although she never admitted it, that she put in a good word for me. Even after Grandad's death, I thanked Janet personally for always interacting with Grandad. Maybe that's what swung it, I'll never know. Those first few months were an education in themselves. There is a world of difference between studying care theory and actually helping someone who's forgotten how to use a fork, or comforting a 90-year-old woman who's crying because she can't remember her children's names. But I found I was good at it, or at least, I found that I cared about doing it well. I stayed at M for 15 years, working my way up from care assistant to senior care assistant, and eventually assistant manager. I love the work. Most of the time, anyway. Of course, there were difficult days, losing residents that you'd grown fond of, dealing with families who couldn't accept what was happening to their loved ones, or the occasional resident who had become aggressive or distressed. But there's something that happened during my time at M, something in my last year there, that I very rarely talk about. not to my colleagues, not to my family, not even to my wife when she was still alive. It's the reason I eventually left Sheffield altogether, taking a job to manage a smaller residential home in Cumbria. And it's the reason I'm writing to you now. Because I think, or should I say, I know, that what happened to me wasn't just grief or stress or imagination. And after listening to some of the tales on your podcast, I hope you and your listeners may understand what I'm trying to tell you. I suppose I should start with Catherine. Catherine was 83 when she came to see us at M. She was exactly the kind of resident who made that job worthwhile. Sharp as a tack, funny in that dry Yorkshire way, and fiercely independent despite needing help with more of the physical aspects of her daily life. She'd been a secretary at the town hall for 40 years, and she had stories about every mayor Sheffield had had since the war, but it was the way she delivered these stories in her own unique style that would have everyone howling in laughter around her. And she would play to that, and she loved it. She reminded me so much of my own granddad, I couldn't help but feel an emotional bond with her. As an assistant manager, I was responsible for medication rounds on the evening shift, and Catherine was always one of my easiest calls. She'd have her pills ready on her bedside table, along with a cup of tea that had usually gone cold while she was reading. We'd have a quick chat about her day or whatever was in the news, and that would be that. Professional but friendly. Exactly how these interactions should be. So that's why I was surprised when her demeanour started to change. Subtly at first, she'd look up when I knocked, but instead of a usual smile, she'd give me this wary look, almost suspicious. I'd hand her the medication, she'd take it, and wouldn't meet my eyes. And then the conversations dried up. After about a week of this, because of the bond I stupidly had formed in my head, I just couldn't ignore it. I said, "Catherine, this is one evening. Have I done something to upset you? You seem like you'd rather I wasn't here." She fidgeted with her cup of tea, rolling it between her hands. "It's nothing you've done, love," she finally said. "It's just..." "Oh, you're going to think I'm going soft in the head." I won't, I told her, and I meant it. "Tell me what's troubling you." She was quiet for so long I thought she decided either to not tell me or had forgotten I'd asked. Then, in a voice barely above a whisper, she said, "I'm being watched at night, Robin. Two figures, just standing there in the shadows by my wardrobe." She nodded in that direction. "They don't move, they don't speak, they're just there." And sometimes, she stopped, looking almost embarrassed. "Sometimes, if I'm asleep, they tap on my foot, in rhythm, like they're trying to get my attention, to wake me up." I kept my expression neutral, the way we're trained to do when residents start talking about hallucinations. "How often does this happen, Catherine?" "Every night, for the past 2 weeks." Her voice then went smaller. "I think they're waiting for me, Robin, to collect me. But don't tell anyone, please. I don't want to be given all those zombie drugs." She pulled a scowling face, meeting my eye for the first time. Here's where I made my first mistake. Catherine was as mentally sharp as they come. No signs of dementia, no history of delusions. But what she was describing to me sounded so much like a textbook hallucination that we would often see with other patients and did come with certain medications that she was referring to. But I should have taken her seriously. I should have listened properly. Instead, I sympathetically nodded and promised to her to not mention anything to the manager of the care home, a lady by the name of Steph. And this brings me on to my second mistake. The next day, during a staff break, in the staff room, I mentioned to Steph in a very, in the staff room, this is off the record, conversational type way, in my eyes at least, about Catherine's night visitors, to see what Steph would suggest. I think, looking back, I was also covering my own back. If Catherine was developing some kind of psychiatric symptoms, I'd hate to be the reason she didn't receive the appropriate care. Steph listened while sipping her coffee and nodding along, and at the end said, "Wow, that's spooky," and walked off. I felt both bewildered and relieved. A relief that would last very briefly. When I came in for my shift the following evening, Catherine's name wasn't on my medication round. It was on Steph's. Steph pulled me to one side and explained they'd added some controlled drugs to Catherine's regimen. Something for anxiety, and something for sleep, and something to stop the hallucinations. Only Steph could issue these controlled medicines. Fair enough, that was not only the policy, that was the legal requirement. But I felt awful. I knocked on Catherine's door to check on her. She was asleep. Or maybe pretending to be. The next night I tried again. This time Catherine was awake, sitting up in her chair by the window, and she turned to see me, and her face dropped. There was no wariness there. It was replaced by something much worse. Betrayal. She stared at me through that window with such disappointment I felt physically sick. I forced a smile and opened the door. "You're not welcome. You told them," she said. It wasn't a question. I stopped halfway in the doorway. "Catherine, you promised me, but you went straight to them, didn't you? And now they've got me on pills that make me sleep so deep I can hardly wake up." Her voice was the steadiest I'd heard in a long time. But I think this was anger. "I trusted you, Robin." I started to explain about policy and proper care, looking out for her well-being. But even to me, the words sounded hollow. The truth was, I had betrayed her trust. She'd confided something frightening and deeply personal, and I'd immediately reported it. At least in her eyes, but also in mine. I'll speak to Steph. We can see if we can change the medication. Find something that doesn't make you so drowsy." Catherine just turned her back to me, staring out of the window. "Don't bother, love. The damage is done now, isn't it?" Well, I left that room feeling like I'd failed at the most basic part of my job, treating residents with dignity and respect. I promised myself I'd make it right the next day. I'd find a way to rebuild Catherine's trust, no matter what it took. I never got that chance. Catherine died in her sleep that night. The official cause was heart failure, and that was not uncommon for someone of her age. But I couldn't shake the feeling that I'd somehow contributed to her death. I know that sounds silly, and I don't mean medically, but by taking away the one thing that might have given her some comfort in those last weeks, someone who believed her. This genuine guilt ate at me. Every resident who mentioned strange dreams or unusual experiences, I found myself wondering, are they like Catherine? Am I dismissing something real because it doesn't fit the usual textbook? I became obsessed with the idea I'd failed not just Catherine, but potentially others who may have been trying to tell me things I just wasn't ready to hear. So, 6 months later, when a position came up to manage a very small residential home in a very rural part of Cumbria, I jumped at it. I told myself it was a career opportunity, going from assistant manager to full manager. and it was a significant step up. But really, I was running from the memory of Catherine's disappointed face. The new place we'll call B, or B House. And it was tucked away in a valley about maybe 20 miles from Keswick. It was smaller than M, only 30 residents compared to R90. And split between general residential care and a specialised dementia unit. The isolation of the area suited me fine. I could start fresh, do better. One of the residents that was a new admittant into the dementia unit was a man named Nigel. He was in the early stages, i.e. lucid most of the time, but with increasing episodes of confusion and memory loss. But what made Nigel more difficult was that he insisted he did not belong there. He'd been a headmaster before retirement, articulate and proud, and he found this whole situation deeply humiliating. But he did belong there. He'd basically went to the school he used to work at and thrown the headmaster of the time out of the office, his own office. According to his family and the police, that was one of just several incidents, which definitely says he should have been there. During our first one-on-one meeting in my office, Nigel seemed completely fine. We discussed his care plan, his preferences for meals, what he liked to do activity-wise. He was professional and straightforward, seemingly fine with his diagnosis. Even when I, at the end of the interview, asked, "Do you understand why you're here?" he quite literally read off all of the reasons he was here, and he was spot on. So I finished up writing, and I turned to place his file in my filing cabinet. When I turned back round, he was staring to the corner of the room, the one to my left, behind me. "You should have more chairs in here," he said to me, then looked back to the corner. I looked around, there were plenty of chairs. "I'm sorry, Nigel." He stood up. "Here you go, love." He addressed the empty corner. "You can take my seat." The hair on my arms stood up. "Nigel, there's no one there." He looked at me like I was being deliberately obtuse. "Don't be ridiculous. It's disgraceful having a woman of her age stood there whilst we sit comfortable." He was now getting agitated. "What kind of a place is this where you don't offer an old lady a proper seat?" I managed to get him back to the communal room with him muttering complaints all the way down the hallway. "Terrible manners. Poor woman shouldn't have to stand in a corner." Over the weeks, these episodes became more frequent. Nigel would be fine during our scheduled meetings, discussing his concerns about his care with perfect clarity. And then he'd suddenly start interacting with someone I couldn't see. Always this woman, always someone he was concerned about. Now the rational part of my mind knew this was textbook dementia behaviour. Hallucinations, especially of people, either family, strangers, even famous people, are quite common as the condition progresses. But something about the consistency bothered me. It was always the same invisible woman, and Nigel always seemed protective of her, worried for her well-being. And then came the day that changed literally everything. I'd called Nigel to my office for our weekly check-in, and he seemed agitated from the moment he sat down. Nodding to me but glancing to the corner, the place he usually saw his invisible companion. "She's upset today," he said without any preamble. "Who's upset, Nigel?" "The lady in the corner. She wants to know why you never apologised," he said, leaning in. The room sincerely went cold. "Apologised for what?" I said, leaning to meet him. Nigel then sat back, perfectly calm, very clear, more lucid than I'd seen him in months, and said quite loudly, "She says you know what you did. She says you betrayed her." He folded his arms as my mouth went bone dry. What does she look like? Nigel, this lady, what does she look like? Why so flustered, Robin? He said with an almost smile. Why don't you look for yourself? He nodded to the corner. I turned slowly. Oh, I see her, I lied. But why don't you tell me how you see her? Well, she's obviously a small woman, grey hair, wearing a blue cardigan. But she's very disappointed with you, Robin. Nigel paused, tilting his head as if listening to something I couldn't hear. Her name's Catherine. She's been trying to get your attention for months. I know the feeling, Catherine, he shouted loudly to the corner. I felt dizzy. There was no way Nigel could have known about Catherine. His file showed he'd lived his entire life in Cumbria. He'd never been anywhere near Sheffield. And he'd definitely never been to M. And I'd never spoke about Catherine to anyone at B House. Why can't you hear her? Nigel snapped. My ears are blocked, I lied. What's she saying now, Nigel? Nigel sighed with exasperation and stared into the corner, nodding. Then he said, something about shadow figures, saying you didn't believe her about the shadow figures. That's when I knew, with absolute certainty, something impossible was happening in my office. The experiences escalated after that. I started seeing glimpses of movement in my peripheral vision at home. Just shadows, nothing distinct. I'd hear footsteps when I was alone. My 5-year-old daughter, Emma, began talking about the sad lady she'd met in our garden. The breaking point came when Emma and I were alone in the local park. I was pushing her on the swings when suddenly she dug her heels into the ground to stop and waved towards the empty field in front of the playground. Who are you waving at, sweetheart? I asked. The old lady, Emma said matter-of-factly. The one who comes to our house sometimes. My blood ran cold. What old lady? The one in the blue cardigan. She's nice, but she's very sad. She then fully stopped her swinging, turned around to face me, and whispered, she told me not to trust Daddy, because she said Daddy doesn't listen when people are scared. I immediately scooped Emma up and practically ran home. That night, I couldn't sleep. I kept thinking about Catherine's words. I trusted you, Robin. And now here she was telling my own daughter not to trust me. The next day at work, I was exhausted and rattled. During my next meeting with Nigel, I was barely paying attention. Until he suddenly said, ears still blocked, I take it. What? I said from my stupor. He nodded to the corner. That empty corner. She wants to know if you'll visit her. Visit who? Catherine! He shouted, clearly frustrated. She says if you go and see her and say you're sorry, she'll stop bothering you. Sounds fair enough to me, said Nigel, looking directly at me. Then back at the corner, nodded again, pulled a very strange face, and still staring at the corner, says to me, she says she doesn't want to frighten your little girl anymore. I gulped, left the room with Nigel still in it, told my assistant to look after Nigel, and said I was taking emergency leave. I jumped in my car, I drove straight to Sheffield. It took a few hours of digging, asking some favours, but I found out where Catherine was buried, a small cemetery on the outskirts of the city. And I raced there. And there I was, after finding her gravestone, staring at it. And I felt ridiculous. It was as if a blanket of logic and rationality had been draped over me. I even shook my head, feeling so stupid. A grown man, and I just raced through streets and towns to stand in front of a gravestone to apologize. But I did it anyway. I apologized for not believing her, for betraying her trust, for treating her fears. It was at this point my cynicism dropped away, and the bond I had with Catherine came flooding back. For treating her fears like symptoms instead of taking them seriously. And I promised her I'd do better. And I meant it. The drive back to Cumbria was the most peaceful I'd felt in months. When I got home, Emma seemed upset somehow. I asked what's wrong. The lady came to say goodbye, Emma said to me with her head down. She said she's not sad anymore because Daddy said sorry. She looked up. I had tears in my eyes, but I tried to hide them. I nodded and said, I did. That's what you do when you're in the wrong. And that was it. No more shadows. No more glimpses of movement. No more visits from Catherine. I believed I could move on. Then one morning, a care assistant knocks on my office door. Nigel's asking to see you. He seems quite distressed. I found Nigel in his room, sitting on the edge of his bed, looking very frightened. Something happened last night, he said as soon as he saw me. Shadow figures stood at the end of my bed. I only know they were there because they tapped on my feet to wake me up. My heart dropped. They were more or less verbatim the same words Catherine had used. They want me to go with them, Nigel continued. But I've told them no, not yet. And now they're angry. I sat down heavily in the chair beside Nigel. I was lost for words, but found myself saying, what can I do for you, Nigel? How can I help? Instead of Catherine's response, Nigel gave me quite the opposite. Anything. Give me something to knock me out. Whatever it takes to get rid of them, Robin, I'm not ready to go yet. Nigel reporting what I could write as hallucinations would pass the reasoning for the controlled substances I was going to give him. And I did. And the medication helped Nigel sleep. But it didn't help me sleep. Because I finally understood what I'd been far too slow to realize with Catherine and possibly many others. Sometimes the things people see in their final months or weeks, they're not hallucinations at all. Sometimes they are very, very real. And sometimes we just don't listen, especially with dementia. We dismiss these fears as symptoms. We're not failing them medically. We're abandoning them. Abandoning them to face something horrifying, terrifying, alone. I still work in care, but as I say, part-time, and I listen differently now. If anyone I visit tells me about strange visitors or unusual experiences, I pay attention. I really listen. I don't always know what to do with it when they tell me, but I've learned that believing in someone costs nothing, and dismissing them can cost everything. Catherine taught me that, in life and apparently in death. I've never told this story to this full extent before, but I just feel someone needs to hear this. Maybe others in care work who've had similar experiences. Maybe I'm not the only one who's learned the boundary between life and death isn't as clear-cut as us medical types would like to believe. Nigel passed away in his sleep, peacefully, 6 months later. No shadow figures, no fear, just a quiet slipping away with his family around him. And I hope that was the truth. But I'll never truly know. Best, Robin. Wow. Robin, That story I literally sent on to a few friends of mine who have an interest in the paranormal. And they were all amazed. They all sent back actual shocked emoji faces, etc. Because the power of your experience is something, hopefully, something none of us have to endure or go through to figure out the split between life and death and the fact of the multiple in-betweens that go therein. Also, dementia in itself is one of those touchstones in the paranormal where it's often questioned about how, as one's mind slips away, do also the preconceived notions we've built up as adults in what our belief system is. As in, when we're children who often report seeing ghosts, imaginary friends, it's very interesting that as those sort of conditional things that you learn from a child growing into adulthood, such as it's an imaginary friend, ghosts don't exist, those things are stripped away from you as the disease starts to strip away your mind, basically, or your being. So it strips away those beliefs and leaves you as open as a child. But regardless of theories and counter-theories, one thing is for 100% certain and real, and that's the fact, Robin, that your email, your story, your experience is genuinely one of the best I've read in a long time. And also my friends, I apologize for forwarding your email on. But to everyone who's just listened to that, thank you for joining me on this great episode, I do believe, of Season 20. Of course, I'll be back with you next week for Episode 7 already of The Dark Paranormal Season 20. And until then, remember, when you're discussing the paranormal, always leave some of your disbelief at the door. And I'll see you next time right here on The Dark Paranormal.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.